Good morning, everyone. The E-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order. And I want to welcome you all here. It's very nice to have such a wonderful crew to work with here. It's reassuring, I think, to see so many familiar faces, and I think encouraging to see so many new faces. So I think it's going to be a good year for education. Yesterday at the, I think they call it a leadership conference over at the University of Minnesota, one of the themes that kept coming up more and more often was the importance of education in the role of the state's economy, the importance of education and taking care of it in a constitutional way. We'll hear about that in a few minutes. But the importance of education from A to Z seems to have a front and center role this year. And I think that's going to make our committee work hard, but also I think there's going to be some real satisfaction at the end. And so I look forward to a pretty interesting year. Very privileged and honored to be the chair. And I certainly look forward to all of your input from all corners, because nobody has a hold on all the ideas. And I think, as Governor Schwarzenegger said in his budget presentation, he said, the more ideas that we have on the table, the better. He said they're all open for discussion, and I think that's a good way to look at it. We have a couple of housekeeping things that I'd like to take care of, and then I would like to have some introductions, because we have a lot of new faces, and a little bit of a flavor as we have members make their introductions, just to kind of maybe talk about the area of the state where your school districts, where your districts are, and some of the districts that you represent. And then today and tomorrow, we have, and we do this about every 4 years, and this is the kind of the overview of education finance in the state of Minnesota. And Eric was saying, well, how many times have I heard this? And I've heard it a number of times. I said, I always get something new out of it. I'm always learning, because there's new information coming out. There's new trends as to what's happening to property taxes or levies or referendums. And so I think you'll find it very, very interesting. It takes about 2 days for staff to go through this. And I believe also we'll have, or I should check with you, but Jack Paulson.
Mr. Chairman, Jack Paulson, for members that are unaware, is the analyst for the Tax Committee, and leadership in its wisdom has double-booked the Tax Committee and the Education Finance Committee in the same time slot. So we're going to try to get Jack to come up and go through some tax stuff, but I think he's got his plate full this morning.
Okay. So maybe tomorrow, if we can get him. So that's what we'll do the next 2 days, today and tomorrow. And then next Tuesday, we have the PS Minnesota group will be coming in and giving their presentation and lay out for us some options to consider. Not that they have everything finalized, but at least lay out the options that they've been working on. And so that kind of takes us into the middle of next week. First off, I'd like to introduce some very important people for the committee to know. Certainly, Jerry in my office. When you call, you'll find this friendly voice answering the telephone. And so Jerry Wenzel, who's been very, very helpful. And then we have Kevin McHenry, who is the committee administrator. So I have changed offices, so I'm not down on ground floor anymore. I'm up in 208, which is right next to the chamber. And Kevin is officed right next to me there. And then we have a couple of very important people. Katie. Katie has been the page the last couple years, 2 years, and does a very efficient job. So all of the information that gets sent out, all of the coffee that we go through and over the year. And then we have a new intern, Carrie. And Carrie is actually from Thief River Falls. She's a junior at the University of Minnesota. And Katie just graduated from University of Minnesota. Oh, Boston. Okay, Boston. All right. So, and then probably the key to this, making this committee function efficiently and getting done what we need to get done, I'd like to introduce Eric Naumann. And Eric is comes with a long, kind of a long background of fiscal work, both in Washington, D.C., and then I think New Jersey. And actually, he is from California. So he has landed here in Minnesota and has been working for the last quite a number of years and does an outstanding job with what we call the numbers. So he's one of the main contacts that when you want questions answered, he is a person that does 110% all the time. And then we have on this side, we have Shelby McQuay. And Shelby is a fiscal analyst for the committee. Now, this will be your third session. And she has outstanding person in terms of fiscal ability. She catches on very, very quickly, and we've given a number of different tasks to her and has come back doing great work. And actually, your doctorate is in what?
Mr. Chairman, members, my doctorate is in geophysical science.
Okay. That's why she understands the finance picture of the education finance so well. And then we have Anne-Marie Yonker, who is our Senate counsel. And Anne has been here for,
12th session.
12th session. Time flies. So, does an outstanding job trying to keep us on track, and especially in the time frames that we have to operate on, especially as we get closer to the end of the session. We also have a new co-chair, and the new co-chair is Senator Bonhoeff right here, and so she will periodically be taking over and stepping in whenever we need that. So with that, I think we'll start with Senator Bonhoeff and maybe just kind of quickly go around. And I know we've had a couple opportunities to introduce ourselves, but I think for the public and for each other, it would be helpful to just give a little bit of information about yourself and interest in education. Senator Bonhoeff.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I am very honored to be the Vice Chair of the E-12 Committee and most importantly to work with you, Mr. Chair, so thank you very much. This is my second session. I began last session serving just 1 year of a four-year session, having been elected in the special election, and I was on the K-12 Committee, Finance Committee last session. I represent District 43, which is Minnetonka, Plymouth and Medicine Lake, and it serves several school districts, the Wayzata School District, Minnetonka School District, Hopkins School District, Robbinsdale School District, and a little slice of the Osseo School District. While I spent 20 years in business, my specialty was marketing. I was a marketing executive in a corporation. I stopped doing that to stay home with my children and got very involved in education, and that's what really had me run for office, was my commitment to doing something in the area of education. So this is my passion in I'm working at the Capitol, and so I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Olson is the lead Republican, and I'm sure she'll be here shortly. And Senator Roebling talked to me yesterday and said she would be a little bit late. So, Senator Anderson.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, very much. It's great to be back here. I'm Ellen Anderson. I've served on this committee for one term, and I've been in the Senate for 14 years and represent a fourth of the city of St. Paul, as well as the city of Falcon Heights, which is a small community that contains the State Fair and the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus, just so you know where I'm talking about. And I have two children in elementary school at a language immersion school in St. Paul. And so the day-to-day issues of our public school system are very real to me, as I told the chairman that I signed them up for Discovery Club so I could make sure I got here on time with our new committee schedule. So so I'm a big supporter of our public schools. And the Falcon Heights community that I represent is in the Roseville School District. In St. Paul, we have four senators representing St. Paul, and we try very hard to make sure we have someone on the E-12 committee. And so I'm very honored that I am serving in that capacity as a St. Paul member of this committee. It's good to be here.
Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Chuck Wigger. I'm in my 11th year in the state Senate, and each of the 10 years previous, I have had the honor of serving on this committee. I was the chair of the school board, North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, before getting elected, and served there for about 17 years. Prior to that, and going back to internships, that's what got me involved when I was 20 years old. I was an intern for the Senate Education Committee, and Jerry Hughes chaired the committee, and I really enjoyed it. And that's what got me to run for school board right after the internship was elected. And a lot of Jerry's ideas for community education, early childhood, we rolled that out, got them implemented. I became the chair of each of those boards in our community after we got them implemented and have been involved ever since. Look forward to.
Senator Wigger, was that under Senator Jerry Hughes?
Yes.
Okay. That goes back a few years.
He'll be here next week, actually, and it'll be fun to talk about some of those same ideas. But he was my mentor.
Great. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm David Hahn. In my fifth year in the Senate from Eden Prairie, our district covers all of Eden Prairie and a little bit of Minnetonka, and three school districts are there, Eden Prairie, all of Eden Prairie School District, part of Minnetonka, and part of Hopkins. Had the honor of serving with Senator Stump on his committee last 4 years, and this is a good committee, and I appreciate the leadership of our chairman. And I'm also glad to hear that, as you said in your opening comments, that you're open to all ideas, and the more are things on the table, the better, and I'm certainly sure that we'll bring some things to the table. But, prior to coming to the Senate, I served on the Eden Prairie School Board for three terms and also have kids in the school, and I'm sure as many of us here believe that education is the most important thing we do in the state. It's the most, the largest part of our state budget, and I think in terms of the future and kinds of opportunity that we need to create for our kids, it's the key, and particularly for, I think, some of the lower socioeconomic demographics, that where education really does and has proven to be over the years to be the engine that drives development. And so anxious to work with the committee this year and looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Therese Ray.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Patricia Torres Ray, and I represent District 62, which is South Minneapolis, the Minneapolis School District. And I am a parent of two children, 12 and 10 years old, who attend the Minneapolis school system, and I am delighted to be here because education really is my passion. I have been a child advocate and work as a program manager with the Department of Human Services for 7 years, but have been doing child advocacy for 16 years. So I'm very glad to be part of this effort to really look at how do we fund public education in Minnesota.
Senator Cole.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I am Senator Amy Koch, and I represent District 19. I have many school districts in my district. It's Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake, St. Michael. I could go on and on. And we're growing. So growth and equity in funding is going to be an issue for me. This is it's my second year and I guess officially second term in the Senate, but still feel quite new at it. I served on higher ed budget last year, and so E-12 is new to me, but I really think that higher ed budget, E-12 budget can find a lot of things we need to work together on because what we do here will, I think, affect the higher ed and the higher ed budget. So looking forward to working with the committee.
Great. Thank you. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Chair. Committee, it's great to be here. I'm Dan Scogin, a new face at the table, and just very pleased to be here and be on this committee. I come out of Senate District 10, Otter Tail, Wadena County, small part of Becker County. We have all rural districts and mostly small school districts up there, but over the past 10 years or so, we have also seen a couple of districts in the west end of my district that became very diverse with Laotian and Hmongs that have come in to work. And so we are starting to feel some of the unusual distractions that some of the Twin City Metro schools have felt for years. And so I'm curious how we are going to deal with some of those issues and look forward to working with you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Sandy Rummel. I am out of Senate District 53, which serves White Bear Lake, Shoreview, North Oaks, Lino Lakes. The school districts served by our district are Centennial, White Bear Lake School District, and the Moundsview School District. And they have very different needs. Lino Lakes is growing, and White Bear Lake and Moundsview are shrinking in size. And so they don't all come out of they don't all represent the same questions. My background, I have 9 years on the White Bear Lake Area School Board, Vice Chair, and 7 years on the East Metro Integration School Board. I was chair there. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to be back on your committee. I've appreciated your leadership. I am Betsy Wergen, and I represent Senate District 16, which is Sherburne, Benton, and Mille Lacs counties, and I have 13 school districts, and what I like the best is that I have school districts that have in excess of 14,000 students to school districts that are far less than 1,000 students. I have one school district that gained 700 students in 1 year, and I have one school district that lost approximately 40 students in 1 year. So I think what's the best is that I'm forced to look at absolutely every bill in its entirety. There's nothing that I can just say, well, this fits my districts, because I don't have one or two districts. I have many to look at, and I really like that. And in my family, we've been fortunate to experience both parochial and public education, so I'm happy to see those two different things and be able to look at them in a different light. And I really enjoy it. Education is one of the primary reasons I ran for the Senate, so I appreciate being here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Saltzman.
Yes, I'm Kathy Saltzman. I'm the new state senator from Senate District 56, which is to the east of this room along the St. Croix River. I have 11 different communities and 3 different school districts, which include the South Washington County School District, and I have the Woodbury portion of that, as well as Stillwater Area Schools and a small portion of North St. Paul, Oakdale, Maplewood. I have been on the other side of this table for 10 years in the audience. I have worked on behalf of 60 school districts in this state on the issue of adequacy and of equity. So for many of you at the table, I have worked for your school districts. I hope to bring a statewide perspective. And to also echo what we heard yesterday, as Senator Stump said, you know, education, I heard from the business community, I heard from our state experts that education is key to the success of this state. And I'm just so excited to work with all of you because you bring such a great perspective and knowledge. And I believe we can be bold in this committee and do great things for Minnesota. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you. I'm Chris Gerlach from Apple Valley. My wife and 2 kids live in Apple Valley. I represent Rosemount and parts of Burnsville as well. And my 5-year-old has started her year in kindergarten in Apple Valley this year, and actually it's the same school I went to, so it's a lot of fun to go back to the same elementary school. And very few, actually, I don't think any of the same teachers are there by now. It's been too long. At any rate, this is my second term in the Senate, and I did serve previously in the House for a few terms as well, and I have never been on an education committee of any sort. Like many committees, they have issues that impact everybody, and it was time, and each term I like to try something new to try to get my arms around a new issue, and this year it just was time to try education, and so I want to learn more of the details and dig in and try to have an impact on the whole issue of education, so I'm glad to be here.
Thank you, Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Terrell Clark, and I obviously have got a frog in my throat. I want to thank Senator Salzman's staff for all of the goodies. I'm very excited to be here. Like Senator Salzman, I spent a lot of time on the other side of the table. I've worked with communities all across the state. And we've got a lot of opportunities in front of us, and it's very exciting thinking about that. My husband Doug and I, we live in St. Cloud. I serve St. Cloud, Wake Park, St. Augusta, Rockville, and Haven. So the bulk of my district is St. Cloud is a regional center, which you will hear from a lot of people in my area. And Rockville is part of the Ricori School District. So slightly different needs. Our kids are now 19 and 21. So we're transitional empty nesters. They're both in college. And like Senator Wergen, we're both in the parochial as well as in the public schools. And it's really important that we do have these great options in front of us. The three things that I hear from our business people as well as from our school district that really impact. And Senator Hand, I was thinking exactly what you were saying. I do believe education is the engine that fuels our economy. It's the big it. And so on the early side, making sure we're closing that achievement gap and that we're getting the most out of our kids early on. Second is the special ed problem. And the third is making sure our kids are really well prepared for a global workplace. And that's both high school and college. And obviously we're going to be connecting, I think, with some of the issues that will transition into higher ed. And thank you so much. I'm looking forward to working with all of you.
Great. Thank you, Senator Clark.
In spite of Mr. Nauman's comments.
We're going to go back. Senator Saxhog, we're just introducing ourselves, a little bit of our district, where we are from. And
20-minute speech. A bit of information.
And we've only gotten this far?
No, we've
no,
got
no,
all
we started
the way
around.
All the way around. Well, then I apologize for being late. I'm glad everybody gets here on time. Usually we've been drinking coffee here for a while. I'm Tom Saxhog. I'm from District 3, and you're probably all sick of hearing the fact that starts at the northwest angle and works its way down to Mille Lacs Lake, but it probably doesn't have any more school districts than many of you, but it does lack in tax base, and it's one of the problems we have in financing education. So, Leroy, you and I have many of the same problems representing the northern part of the state.
Thank you, Senator Sackville. Senator Scheid.
I'm Linda Scheid, representing four school districts in the northwest suburbs, Anoka-Hennepin, the state's largest district, the Osseo School District, where I live and where my children grew up and went to school, Robbinsdale School District, another large school district, and then the small Brooklyn Center School District. About 40-some years ago, I think it was 42 or 43 years ago, I was a teacher in Ethiopia in the Peace Corps, and if you were warm and spoke English, they sent you to teach English in the Peace Corps in those days. And I was and did, and so but it was never trained to be a teacher. But in the last 7 years, I have had a wonderful experience of being able to go back and do some substitute teaching, actually, with a limited license. If you have an undergraduate degree and the districts need you the state will issue you that license if you have an undergraduate degree. So I love it. Education is also my passion, and there are a lot of passionate people in this room, and that's a good thing. And I mean, at the table, but also around the room, and there's usually a full room, and I love seeing that. My particular interest in recent years is early childhood education, and I'm glad that it's part of this division. Frankly, I think we'll have an opportunity to do more with it than we've had in the past, and. We all owe Senator Hottinger a big thank you for bringing it to the forefront in the Senate. Look forward to working with all of you. You're I appreciate your leadership, Mr. Chairman, and I, too, am glad to be here.
Okay, thank you very much. And the other two that are missing, well, I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to hear from them. I'd also like to introduce Claire Noble from the Department of Education. And Claire is kind of the government relations person for the department. And also Donna Swanson. Welcome. And we have, is it Britta? And I don't have your last name, Britta, from the Department of Finance. Would you like to just come up and you're just introduce yourself?
Sure.
She used to work for Roger Moore.
And I believe Britta is a executive budget officer. Sure. Just take a quick chair and introduce yourself so people know who you are. And
she asked me 20 questions.
Hello, members. My name is Britta Raton, and I am a budget officer with the Department of Finance. I also work with Brian Steves, who is not here this morning because we're doing a lot of work on the budget, as you might imagine. But we both are budget officers for the Department of Finance working on education issues.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. These are people that we all at some point work very closely with as we put the budget together. I was going to grab my budget document book as I was going out of my office from 2 years ago. And it is a little bit overwhelming when you first look at it. It's about, you know, about 3-4 inches thick and lots and lots of fine print. But don't be overwhelmed by it, because as we go through the budget, there's a lot of help that most of us get along the way from staff people and department people, and so we kind of all work kind of side by side learning as we go. And I think one of the challenging things is to fashion a budget bill in the education area that tries to address a lot of the concerns that many of you have mentioned around the table. I mean, all the districts have their own distinct characteristics and differences, and that's the real challenge for this committee, is to figure out how and where and how do we fit all this together so that it makes all of our districts operate in a successful way. So those are just there's just a whole lot of help that we'll get along the way. We do have one. I see one superintendent here that came an awful long ways. He happens to be the superintendent from my home district, Irv Peterson from Thief River Falls, and has done an excellent job. He's been in a number of school districts and has worked very hard up there. So with that, is there anyone that I'm not? Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, members and Senator Stumpf. I'm sorry I'm late. My husband and son, who's home from college, went up to Mille Lacs ice fishing, and I had to do the farm chores this morning before I could come. Anyway, I'm excited. This is my first time on the K-12 funding or P-12 funding division, but I've worked on early childhood issues quite a bit, and I've worked on higher ed issues a lot. And so I see this as a wonderful opportunity to try and link those, because I know how important it is to have children ready for kindergarten, and I want to continue working on that. And I also know that we have somewhat of a problem in our higher ed system when almost one-third of our incoming students have to take remedial classes. And so I see this as a great opportunity to focus on that and those issues in particular, and try and make more of a seamless system for our students and hook this all together. And I know there's efforts being made in that direction, but I think we can do more. And it's going to take some funding, and so it's important to be on a funding division to see that happen.
Great. Thank you. Well, thank you very, very much. And we'll try to keep coffee and for you on members as you come down to the committee. And we're going to turn it over to some of our staff. So, Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman and members, again, my name is Eric Nauman. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee, and I think I've been here, this is maybe my 11th session, Mr. Chairman, with this committee. Welcome back. It's good to see friendly faces, and this briefing I would hope to be an interactive one. We have some charts that we will go through, and as the chairman mentioned, if we do it quickly, we can get through everything in about 3.5 hours. We won't try to do all of it today, but we're anticipating that there's going to be questions, and we hope there are as we proceed. As a matter of introduction, please forgive me for any name pronunciation. Some of you are new. Senator Han was Senator Han for a long time in my world, 4 years ago. So I think
I've changed.
You've changed? I just got it right, Senator.
Excuse me, Eric, just before you start, I'm just wondering, members, would it be helpful if we just turn the lights down just a little bit? I know there's some reflection. Or not.
Yeah, there is some reflection.
Just if there'd be a way to just dim them just a tad so we can see the actual slides. Okay, Mr. Nauman.
They're so cute and they move.
The purpose of this briefing, Mr. Chair and members, is to acquaint you with one of the more complicated areas of the state budget. We constitute almost 42% of the general fund, and this committee is responsible for making those appropriations. And what we intend to do is start a little bit with budget process, as the chairman mentioned, talk about the constitutional mandate, then try to confuse you with some basic education finance terms, go into some detail on the education budget, take a little backward step and remind you of the 2001 reform. This was under Governor Ventura, called the Big Plan, what it intended to do, what has happened subsequent to that. Put our green eye shades on and talk a little bit about people accounting. Going to general education, this constitutes the bulk of where the dollars will get spent in this committee. Discuss the referendum. Go into, and that's probably as far, if we're lucky, we'll get today. Then we'll go into reserve revenues and penalties, special education. And I should mention that Ms. McQuay will be doing most of the briefing tomorrow. We'll then discuss capital facilities, early childhood accounts, which are new to this division. So that will be an important part of the discussion. Where to get more information, and then just a reminder of who the faces are that we've already discussed this morning. So as I mentioned, we'll talk budget process, constitution, and some basic terms first. We put these little break slides in here to say as a point for logical questions, but that doesn't mean that you have to have them. So at the outset, are there any questions before we begin? Okay. This first slide is intended to show you a bit of a timeline, how things work, and this would apply generally across any other budget divisions that you might sit on. Instruction advisories are issued early on at the executive level in the June-July timeframe. Agencies formulate their requests in the September through November timeframe. The November forecast sets the numbers. It calculates revenues, it calculates spending, and gives us a financial picture of where we are at this point. So that's where we are right now, because we haven't had another update since then. There are periodically revenue estimates that come out on a monthly basis. Session begins in January. The governor's budget will be prepared and issued in late January. I think, Britta, is it the 22nd that we're shooting for this year? There will be a forecast in February. Britta, has a date been set for that yet? Not to put more work on you, but towards the end of February. The price of government is a report that comes out and allows us to take a look at both local and state expenditures as well as spending. How much is government costing relative to a variety of economic measures? The legislature may or may not do a budget resolution. We usually try to do one, but sometimes that doesn't always happen. Committee deadlines are usually in the April timeframe. And conference committee will follow shortly after budget bills are passed. So this chart is just intended to give you a sense of some of the timelines. At this point, I'd like to ask you to take a look at the packets that we've given you. You have all the slides that we're going to be talking from. And if you want to move on ahead, if we're droning along, you can do that. But more importantly, we thought we would take this opportunity to acquaint you with some of the documents that you will be seeing in this committee. Members that have served here probably know them fairly well. In order, the first one is a legal document that looks like this. This is probably the most important fiscal document you will have. It's the AIDS tracking. This is the education money that is spent out of this committee from the general fund. And across the columns is EOS, means end of session, and then the November forecast. So all we have here presented are the accounts with the end of session data, where the legislature left at the end of last session, and then the update for the November forecast. As we move forward, we will add the governor's recommendation, the February forecast, a Senate bill, a House bill, and finally a conference committee report, all of which is designed to provide members information. There's a lot of numbers here. I call this document Full Employment for Fiscal Analysts. So in any case, we can go into greater detail on that. The second document that you have is the E-12 tax budget. This committee is unique in that it has both spending and taxing authority in it. This committee can raise property taxes. This committee can reduce property taxes. It's that for that reason that this once you produce an education bill here, you will make a first stop in the Finance Committee, and then the bill will make a second stop in the Tax Committee, where both committees will review the decisions that you have made before the bill goes to the floor. Part of that's to ensure that if one committee of jurisdiction on the tax side is reducing taxes, that this committee isn't jacking up taxes at the same time, to make sure that everything stays in balance. The next document that I would like to call your attention to is a document that looks like this, fiscal status category sort. If we have our engines firing at a staff level, we hope that you will have a document like this before every committee meeting, and its intention is to show you how much money the bills are before you are spending. Sometimes the process is not working as efficiently as we'd like, and some of the data will not be final. But the idea is at the bottom of the page, you'll see a total aid impact and a total levy impact for the bills that are on your agenda. It's intended to give you some magnitude of what you're hearing in a given day. Then we have the entitlement tracking sheet. It looks like this. It's a legal sheet. Inside the general education program is, and as we're going to talk about 12 or 13 different individual programs, ranging from the basic formula allowance to equity to QComp. And on the spreadsheet that we began with, it's rolled into frequently a single number. This is intended, when we put together the K-12 bill or at various important steps in the process, to break some of those out so that you can see the calculations that, you know, where the numbers are changing, how they're affecting the individual programs. You won't see this one quite as frequently. Unless there's a logical point, the next time you'll see it will be when we do the February forecast. There'll be a comparison between November and February. We may put one together for the governor's bill, and then certainly when we do the Senate bill. New for this year is the Senate District Charter School Database, and that's a document that looks like this. This is not something we will prepare and bring every day, but its intention is to provide you background data, historical data. So often we get requests, how much money is my school getting? How much money was my school getting in fiscal year 2002 through 2007? We've put together a database that tracks this. So we have three sample databases three sample runs. Each district has four pages. The first two pages are fiscal data, and you can see it's revenues. First, the A section is pupils. Then we have revenues for the next two pages, and it goes through all the major revenue categories, on a per pupil basis as well as total revenues, and you can see it over time. When revenues are rolled into other formulas, we try to make that notation, and then we make some percentage calculations. Sometimes it's information overload, but sometimes to answer some of your specific questions, it's useful. Then the next few pages show you information like the building age, the square footage. This is important to some of the formulas that we'll discuss later. Teacher pay, special education cross subsidy, which we'll talk a little bit more about tomorrow. I skipped over something. Some of the fall populations, enrollments, which of course drive a lot of the formulas, secondary dropout rates and mobility. School districts will frequently come before you and talk about why mobility is an important factor and why don't we have a formula that recognizes mobility and those kinds of issues. These are not things that you will use on a regular basis, but it's intended to provide some background information. We have all school districts and all charter schools built into the database, and we probably, although I'm not sure, will provide the caucus staff with access to the entire database. If you needed a specific district from us, just call myself or Shelby, and we'll be pleased to print out whatever districts you need. It's about this thick when we print everything, so we didn't do it. If you can visualize 341 districts and a whole bunch of charter schools, and 4 pages each, it gets really big real quick. So, I went backwards. Then the next document, we're getting through this a little slow, but I'll move quickly. Sometimes when you have a bill, and we will do this for the big bill, there will be a summary. Looks like this. Amory and Shelby prepare these documents. Most bills that come before this committee will have a summary. Gives you some layman's language about what the bill does, what's its intended purpose. Sometimes when you have a bill, it will come forth with a fiscal note. Looks like this. I picked Senator Clark's from last year because it has both an aid and a levy impact on it. The aid side is real clear. You can read across the very first page. It tells you in a glance what the general fund impact. In this case, in fiscal 07, we were estimating a revenue increase. The Department of Finance and the Department of Education collectively were estimating a revenue increase of $48.8 million for this bill. You can see that it escalated beyond that. That's not the end of the story. This bill also carried a levy impact, and sometimes that's not always clear, and because we have aid and levy jurisdiction in this committee, we try to keep our fingers in balance on that side of the equation as well. Sometimes it's not clear unless you look at the line listed local government costs. That's on the third page. Levy authorities would increase under the amounts shown above. That's a good tip-off that there's levy increases in this fiscal note. We encourage you to read your fiscal notes. Sometimes they won't happen, and if you have a bill on the agenda, we will try to make sure that the fiscal note is completed before it gets to you. Sometimes that doesn't always happen. I request fiscal notes in the process, so if you have a bill that needs a fiscal note expedited, call us and we'll make sure that that happens. That was the fiscal note. Finally, the last type of document that we will bring to you is a district-by-district data run. This takes a proposal, sometimes a bill, sometimes the entire education bill, and does a estimate, and we put emphasis on estimate of the costs, either property tax side or revenue side, of a given bill. It's intended to show the effects of the bill on various school districts. We can produce these for you for your bills, and we will produce one at the end of the your work here to estimate the overall impact of the bill that you produce. The idea is to show you a general estimate of what the proposals or the bill does. It's not right. I emphasize that because it's only as good as the input data that we have, and I can tell you that we know with absolute certainty that it's wrong. But as much as I say that, I call it the downfall of Western civilization, the data run, because it's so easy to vote on a data run. So it's important to the process, but keep in mind, we know the data is only as good as the inputs that we have. So now, that's a good point. Are there questions about these documents? It's all clear. Good. Okay. Four years ago, we started this discussion with the constitutional mandate. And I, when we do this lecture sometimes for or conversation, rather, to college graduate classes, we always start here. The education finance portion that you oversee is unique in that there is a constitutional mandate that says what you are supposed to do. And I'd like to take the time to read it. The stability of a Republican form of government depending mainly upon the intelligence of the people, it is the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. The legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise that as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state. Most states have a similar constitutional mandate. There is, the court systems have been littered with interpretations of what this means. Legislative discussions have gone back and forth about what this really means. The advantage is that you have something that you can cling on to as a committee that says, here's what we are supposed to do. Not every committee has that benefit. So I like to start here and say, you can quibble about what thorough and efficient and general and uniform actually means, and I'm sure you will, but at least this gives you something as a mooring for your discussions. So I always like to start and end there. Basic terms. This is where we get into the meat. Revenue. It's a simple notion. It's money that school districts have to spend. Revenue comes from two places. It's either a property tax revenue levy or it's aid. And the simple rule of thumb is that aid equals revenue minus levy, or put the other way around, aid and levy together equal aid and levy together equal to revenue. That makes sense? Okay. Please interrupt with questions. It makes this so much easier. I don't have to talk the whole time. Acronyms. ADM stands for Average Daily Membership. It's an average count of pupils in the classroom. It's an average. It's not you walk into every classroom and count the kids, and that's what an ADM is. It's averaged over the course of the year. Pupils, then, for the purpose of the formula, are weighted by grade, and these are called WADAs. This is an old way that we used to end the calculation there by weighting, and then we would multiply those numbers through the formula. But in 1999, we added something else called AMCPUs and RMCPUs. These are adjusted marginal cost pupil units, which is kind of a mouthful. But what we do is adjust school districts' pupil counts. Sorry, my spouse just walked into the room. She warned me she was going to do that. But to effect for declining pupils, we allow school districts to count 23% of their count from the prior year and add that to 77% of their count from this year. So it allows them to recognize roughly a quarter, to hang on to roughly a quarter of the decline in any year to year, and sort of, and the intent is to mitigate some of the impacts of declining enrollment. ANTC.
In that regard, there are some other proposals, and I believe next week we'll hear about one of them from PS Minnesota that tries to address some of those same issues in a little different fashion. So I think the caveat is that some of these formulas that we currently use are not, you know, the be-all, end-all. There may be better ways of doing certain things and trying to address certain problems. But
yes, and Mr. Chairman, this was just a solution that what the legislature arrived at in 1999 and was amended in 2000 sessions. But as you said earlier, everything's on the table. So ANTC, we use two primary measurements of tax base for the purposes of calculating levies in the state. One is the adjusted net tax capacity, and the other is the referendum market value. And Referendum market value was developed for the purposes of doing the operating referendum back in the 2001 reform. It is basically the ANTC, all taxable property in the district, excluding seasonal recreational property and agricultural lands. So those are mainly the acronyms. We'll get into more detail about them. We have a few more. An allowance. We'll talk about an allowance a lot in this committee. The statutorily determined number that, when multiplied by the pupils in a district, generates the revenue amount that all districts have to spend. For example, this committee will set the formula allowance. That's the big number. Right now it's 49.74, which is the agreed-upon number that this committee and the House agreed on in the 2005 legislative session. In very simple terms, you multiply that times the pupils in the district, and you have the amount of revenue. Equalization. This is a process of reducing the impact of property wealth to generate revenue for school districts by appropriating state aid. State aid is appropriated at higher amounts for districts with relatively less property wealth. And as we talked about before, revenue equals the levy and the aid together. So as you increase in property wealth, you raise more of your revenue off of the property tax and less off of the state aid. The converse is also true. An equalizing factor is also a statutorily determined number that you have. It's a policy lever that this committee may choose to consider, but it's the point at which equalization occurs. So if you are above that number, no equalization is earned, no state aid is earned on that formula for a district. If you're below it, you receive state aid, and the further below it you are, the more state aid you receive. Fiscal year. This seems like a very simple term, but I was chatting with a graduate student the other day who said, "What is it?" So we put it in here. It starts July 1 and ends July 30th. It's fiscal year 2007. 2008 and 2009 is the biennial budget that you are setting, and that begins on July 1. This is a momentary diversion from the terms. I wanted to put in a chart that shows how equalization works. I talked about this just briefly. What we have on the scale going up is increasing revenue per pupil, and going across to the right is six hypothetical districts with increasing property value per pupil. And the yellow part is state aid. The blue part is the property tax levy. So you can see District 3 that raises hypothetically 700. All of these districts would be raising $750 up to District number 5. And if a District number 1 would receive all state aid under this hypothetical example, District number 5 would be all levy. 2, 3, and 4, you can see, have a mix of aid and levy. Based on the equalizing factor. And this line here, the line that divides the two, represents the equalizing factor. That makes sense? It was hopefully trying to make some sense out of it. And then a few more terms. Free and reduced lunch we use primarily in the compensatory formula. It's a measurement of poverty based on eligibility for free lunch or reduced price lunch. An aid entitlement is the 100% of state aid given by the state to a district or charter that a district or a charter school is eligible to receive in a given fiscal year. It may or may not be actually paid entirely in the fiscal year to which it's attributable. In some cases, it's split between fiscal years. Categorical aid is funds paid to a school district for a designated purpose. Nutrition is a good example. Money is provided. They have to spend it on nutrition. They can't spend it on teacher salaries or something else. An appropriation and aid entitlement go together. The appropriation is the amount that's actually appropriated in a given fiscal year. And we have what's called, you'll hear us talk about the 90-10 splits. There are several formulas that are paid out 90% in one fiscal year and a lagging payment of 10% in the subsequent year. this is where it gets very confusing, but it's just, for now, just keep in mind that there is an aid entitlement, the amount that's attributable to the fiscal year, and then there's the amount that's actually appropriated. Any questions on the terms up to this point? Either I'm doing a terrible job or a good one, so I hope it's the latter. So we'll now move into the education finance budget and a little bit of a look back. Here's the budget as it stands based on the November forecast. And these numbers tie directly back to the aid spreadsheet that we talked about before. In 06, there was $6.8 billion, and you'll notice that general education is the biggest piece, $5.8 billion. Vastly, as I warned you earlier, this is the biggest piece of what you do. There are other pieces that are beginning to get larger. Special education is a large piece. And facilities, while declining, remains an important piece for us to consider in this committee. Dropped to $6.4 million in 07. We can talk about that. That's primarily a shift-induced reduction because fiscal year 06 was artificially high because we were paying back shifts associated with the budget fixes in the early in the 03 to 05 timeframe. And then you'll notice that the estimates are now at $6.5 and $6.4 billion.
And Mr. Nauman, does that include the local property tax?
Mr. Chair, you anticipated my next slide, which is the property tax side. You'll see property taxes at $1.3 billion in 06, growing to $1.6 billion in 07, $1.7 billion in 08, and $1.9 billion in 09. There's been a fair amount of property tax growth over the time period, and we're estimating that they go above $2 billion by the end of the forecast period.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back then to the other slide? I just want to see if the rate of growth, all that appears. I can't see that fiscal year. What is the fiscal year 2009?
Am I in front of it?
Yeah, thank you.
6.4.
So I notice in that slide it goes down, and yet on the property tax side it's going up. Can you explain that?
There's Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonner, there's a couple reasons why that would be happening. The first most obvious is that between fiscal year 06 and 07, you will this slide is slightly deceptive, as I mentioned, because of the shift buybacks. We actually have a formula allowance increase of 4% that occurs between 06 and 07. So without the shift buybacks, you would see in the general education line and the total line an increase between those 2 years. When we get into 08 and 09, part of the decline is attributable to declining pupil counts. With respect to the property tax side, some of the growth is policy change that the legislature has established in years past. A good portion of it is growth in property values. The formulas are sensitive to the value of property in a school district. If you think about your own property tax bill in the last few years, it's probably been growing. And that's happening across the state. As the valuation of property grows, we get more school districts look wealthier, and the formulas end up reflecting that. So more revenue is raised on the levy side, and then less state aid comes to the state.
And Senator Salzman?
To the district.
Yes. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to point out, I guess, that if we go back to the equalizing factor, which we discussed earlier, that has not been adjusted since 1993. And so that's why I believe that when we do see our property values going up, many of our districts are losing equalization, and that's why we're seeing this increase. Part of the reason we're seeing an increase in property taxes. And I guess that as people in a community see their property taxes go up and don't see their schools getting any additional money, I mean, because you're getting less state aid, I think that's why a lot of a lot of people are very upset about property taxes because they're not seeing anything come back to their community. They are losing less of their state aid. Would that be a sort of an accurate statement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, I'll comment on the factual piece. The formula, the equalizing factors have indeed not been adjusted in many years. We did create a second tier on the referendum, and I think you and I were specifically previously talking about the referendum equalizing factor. A second tier was created at sort of a half level, mm-hmm. and my original chart didn't actually show that. It was intended to be a simpler version. But there are two levels of equalization. One is more robust at the lower end, and there's a higher one. So that has been adjusted. But in terms of the lower end, that hasn't been adjusted since its initial inception, I believe, in 93. I'm glad we got some questions. This is our little look back at the 2001 education reform. We used to have a general education levy that this committee would routinely set. And in 2001, the legislative session of 01, the value of that levy was $1.3 billion. The actual, and in that year, the legislature took it over, paid for it with state aid, and the total cost of that was an $880 million after netting out credits on the income tax. It was a big conversation that the legislature had that year. At the same time, supplemental and transition revenue programs, which were separate categorical programs, were rolled onto the referendum authority. And then we took $415 of referendum revenue and transferred it onto the formula allowance. So if you visualize that there are two pieces, referendum and a formula allowance, we reduced the referendum of $415, and we added $415 to the formula allowance. So any school district that had a referendum at 415 or lower, or I should say anything lower than 415, got new money equal to the difference between the two. Any district that was above that didn't get new money but generally received property tax relief as a result of that. Then the policy goal behind it was to reduce the property tax levies in the system. In 2002, the last year before the effective date of this buyout, we had 33% property tax in the general education and referendum system. That dropped down to about 4%. Then if you take a look at where we are this year, you can see it's crawled back. Not all the way, but we are definitely adding property tax back into the system. Some of that's policy choices, and some of it, as we discussed with Senator Bono's question, was also valuation changes. If you were to plot the education aids on a graph since that time, that's represented by this red line here, and the property tax levies are the yellow line. And you can see in the middle, there looks like a fairly healthy growth in the state aid in the 04 to 07 timeframe. And some of that is actually real, but there's also shifts in there. And that was, again, to fix some of the budget problems. If you adjust for the shifting, the real spending looks more like this green line.
Mr. Nauman, is that... how does inflation play into that real line?
What I mean by real, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not actually speaking about inflation whatsoever here, what I'm referring to is that to help balance the state budget, and we talked about that term of an appropriation versus an entitlement. We set an entitlement for a given year, and then we actually appropriate dollars in another year. I also mentioned that 90-10 payment schedule. 90% of a payment comes in one fiscal year, and then there's a lagging payment of 10%. What the legislature did to help balance the budget in the 2002 and 2003 legislative sessions was to adjust that payment schedule. And if you reduce the 90% payment to something like 80, which is what we ultimately did, you save 10% revenue actually in payments that the state had to make to districts. and that gives you a one-time savings. A law was passed in the 2004 session that once we got past the budget problems and the revenues and spending started returning to the positive side, that those had to be paid back. So what we're seeing in the red line versus the green line is first the difference here is savings from the shift, and the difference here is increased spending versus the shift. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. What would happen if you would put another line on there tracking the reserves of school districts?
Mr. Chairman, we could certainly do that. I think you'd find it's very spotty.
Okay.
Some districts, I mean, I'm not sure you can generalize. We would have a total number of what the reserves are, but I think on a district-to-district basis, you're gonna find some districts that have large reserves and other districts that have smaller reserves.
Okay. Senator Rummel?
Mr. Chair, going back to your question, does the green line represent actual dollars or inflation-adjusted dollars?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rummel, I'm sorry, I did sort of slide past that unintentionally. These are just dollars appropriated. Can we move on? Pupil accounting. Any questions up to this point? Okay. We mentioned ADMs before. We divide ADMs into a resident count and a ADM served count. The residents are districts enroll, district residents, students that live in a given school district. And those served are resident ADMs, plus any non-residents attending a district or a charter school under open enrollment, minus the residents attending another district or charter school under open enrollment. So the idea is, and this was a policy the legislature began, I think, in the 99 bill, where we are actually, our formulas are geared to students where they are actually attending. So if I'm a student that lives in Minneapolis and I'm attending school in St. Paul, most of the revenue would follow, I would generate revenue for the school that I'm actually attending in St. Paul as opposed to the district where I actually live. And we do two counts because the referendum is handled differently. We'll get to that in a moment. I mentioned that we weight students by grade. Pre-kindergarten and kindergarten disabled students are weighted at 1.25. Regular kindergarten students are weighted at 0.557. Grades 1 to 3 at 1.115. 1.06 for 4 to 6 and 7 to 12 is 1.3. You can see by the wide variety of these numbers that there's a collection of legislative decisions that these represent.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelman, can you go back to that slide?
Of course.
I'm confused about the pre-K and K disabled weight because we don't serve those pre-K students in the public school system, so how does that factor?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoeff, we actually do serve them for, you know, when a student has a disability or there are certain pre-K kids that do receive some service in the K-12 system, they are weighted at 1.25, the idea being that there are higher costs associated with those kids. So they are served in the system, not all of them, which I think you're thinking about perhaps some of the all-day K proposals. But these are the general kindergarten student is weighted at the 0.557, which reflects a half day rather than a full day.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelman, so the only way that they're assigned a weight is if we're serving them.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonhoeff, as we talked about with the ADMs, there's three steps in the pupil count process. First, you show up in a classroom and we create an average count. That's the ADM. And depending on the age and the grade of that student, they are assigned a weight. And with respect to the kindergarten, if they fit the pre-K or the kindergarten disabled category and are showing up in the classroom, they receive a weight of 1.25, which when it goes through the formulas is going to generate higher revenue for the school district. Then it's a fairly straightforward matter of regular kindergarten, grades 1 to 3, 4 to 6, and 7 to 12.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, when was the last time we dropped to 1 for the lowest one? So that, you know, we'd actually have a
1?
A base rate.
Mr. Nolan.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roblin, it preceded me, but my recollection of stories told to me, I believe, is that it was 1993 when we first created the class size reduction language. And you'll see the 115 and the 06 in the grades 1 through 6. Those are residuals of class size reduction initiatives. So in other words, I believe that prior to 93, the weights for 1 to 6 were, in fact, 1 at that point. But I'm not certain. I'd be happy to check it.
Thank you.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there, over the years, I mean, those are some pretty precise numbers. Is there scientific evidence that has been presented over the years that says, you know, I mean, you're to the point, you know, 115. Where do these come from?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, they come from legislative decisions. We have a, like many things in K-12, we have a formula allowance of 49.74. Why wasn't it 75? Well, I think when we had our targets, we didn't have the extra million dollars to put it at 49.74. Sometimes these decisions are backed into based on the amount of money available. These weights do turn into actual money once you multiply them through the formulas. And I can tell you that the 115, because I had a hand in it, was in 99, and it was based on what we had available at that time.
Yeah. Senator Gerlach, you'll realize if you've been here long enough how scientific we are.
Oh, yeah. Senator Worthen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric, going back to Mr. Nauman, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Going back to the pre-K, is that not partially the Minneapolis program of four-year-olds that we have? That's the primary piece of that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Worthen, not this piece. This is just simply the weights. There is a 4% factor in the trend. 4% of the Minneapolis program for which you are speaking is actually paid under current law in the transition revenue program.
Senator Worthen?
Mr. Chair, I asked that very poorly. Minneapolis gets 1.25 for the four-year-olds that they serve under the program. That's unique to Minneapolis. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Worthen, if Minneapolis has, and any school district has, pre-K or kindergarten disabled kids, they will be weighted at that level. I think you might be thinking of that initiative that we've been dealing with in this committee, and that's paid for under the transition revenue program, which would be a separate calculation. All we're doing at this point is counting kids based on primarily on their grade, with one exception. That 1.25 is for if they fit a certain category.
Mr. Nye.
That's a good point because we're going to come back to that when we get to transition. So this was intended just to plot where we are right now, and prior to 99, it looked like this. So an initiative was held in the 99 bill to bring up the weights slightly in the grades K through 4. And now we get into the marginal cost pupil units. RMCPUs are used to calculate the operating referendum. AMCPUs, adjusted marginal cost pupil units, are used to calculate most other formulas. As I mentioned previously, it was enacted to ease the impact of declining enrollment pupils. Districts with enrollment declines, and declines only, allowed to count 77% of their current year WADMs and 23% of their prior year WADMs, and together they equal the R or AM CPUs. Growing school districts count only the current year. So we provide the marginal cost on the declining side, but not on the upside. It kind of looks like this. I like the bouncing pies, so I do that a couple of times.
The rationale, Mr. Nolan, for that was that when you have declining enrollment, and a lot of districts do, is that it's harder to back out of those committed expenditures in a given period of time than it would be to adjust for an increased number in a growing district, I believe. I think that was sometimes there's contracts, sometimes there's you can add a student, let's say, to a class, but it's hard to, if you take a student out, you can't unexpend sometimes as fast as you can increase.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gerlach, going back to your previous question, why 77%? It's the same answer. It's what we had available at the time. Why not 75? We had a little extra there. compensation pupil units. These are a pupil unit count primarily for the compensatory formula based on students eligible for free and reduced price lunch at each school building. In the counting, free lunch students count as a full pupil, and reduced price lunch students count as one half. And the greater the concentration of students eligible for free and reduced price lunch in a building, the higher amount of compensation pupil units, which ultimately, when we get into the formula, is going to generate more money for the higher concentrated school versus the lower concentrated school. Concentration is an important aspect of our current compensatory formula. And this, as we move into the PS Minnesota report, maybe which I believe we're going to hear next week, is an important factor because their report moves away from concentration. LEP pupil units. This is limited English proficiency, an acronym I think I forgot to use in the discussions. Student who first, and these are based on the following criteria, student who first learned language other than English and comes from a home where the language is usually spoken is other than English. A student who is determined to lack the necessarily English skills to fully participate in classes taught in English, and a student who scores below the state cutoff score on an assessment measuring emerging academic English. We have a concentration calculation here, and at some point we can crawl into the details of how these are calculated. But we do these calculations to weight the students for the purposes later in the LEP formula. A break point. We've counted most of the kids at this point. Okay. Now we're going into the general education program, and this is probably where we're going to finish most of today. Mr. Chairman, before I go too far, what is our break point today, the time when you had intended to complete our work today?
Mr. Nauman, I think, and committee members, I think it's 11 o'clock. We'll try to finish up by 11.
Caucus.
10:30?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just today.
Oh, 10:30. Okay. I believe it's a little sooner than 11, so okay. Closer to 10:30.
Okay. All right, so we'll try to get through general education. The easiest formula to calculate is also the biggest that you will be asked to take a look at. I've mentioned the formula allowance a number of times, but I've got a historical tracking here. Back in 99, it was 35-30, and we're now at 49-74. That's not all new money. Some of it has been roll-ins. Sometimes this committee or the House will make a decision to roll in an existing formula into the general education basic formula allowance, and that increases the number. You'll see there was a big jump between 2002 and 2003. Some of that was new money, about $200 of it was new, but there was also the 415 transfer that occurred at that time. That was money rolled from the referendum, as we talked about before. It's about $4.7 billion in the estimates for the current year total. And that's the bulk of the money that school districts have to spend during the course of the year. And it's the most flexible. Extended time revenue. Revenue equal to extended time formula allowance multiplied times the extended time pupil units. In the 2003 legislative session, the legislature took a decision to limit, I think I have some of this. Here's the current formula allowance at 4601. There's no requirement that the basic formula and the extended time formula allowance must be equal. That's a holdover from a few years ago when they were the exact same number. Since then, we've moved past that. There's $52.4 million in this formula. It's basically kids that are taking summer school. We used to allow school districts to count additional ADM for the purposes of students that are taking classes after hours or during the summer. And the legislature in 2003, as part of a budget-cutting move, limited the amount of ADM that a school district was allowed to count and created a formula so that we locked it in at existing levels. It saved money into the future, but not in the current year at the time that that was done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelman, and that was not restored in any way after that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, this briefing reflects current law.
Thank you.
Compensatory revenue. This is where we do the compensatory counts. Districts receive additional funding for districts eligible for free and reduced lunch. As we mentioned before, free and reduced lunch is a measure of poverty, and the higher the concentration of poverty as measured by free and reduced lunch, the more revenue is received. Revenue must be, under this line, must be allocated to the site where the pupil generated the revenue. And compensatory revenue is equal to a district's compensation pupil units multiplied times its basic formula allowance minus 415. Why 415? Because when we rolled the 415 onto the from the referendum onto the formula allowance, a majority of the legislature believed that compensatory should not increase just because it was referendum money moved onto the formula. When you add a dollar to the formula allowance, compensatory also increases. So that was felt to be an artificial increase in compensatory. $315.6 million in the current fiscal year. This line. LEP revenue provides revenue to assist students whose English language ability needs improvement. These are the LEP counts that we talked about before. It has two separate formulas, a regular and a concentration. LEP regular revenue is $700 multiplied times a greater of 20 or the LEP pupil units. Concentration revenue is $250 multiplied times the students, multiplied times the LEP students times the LEP pupil units. And the LEP revenue in total is the sum of both.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelman, that was one of the cuts in 2003, was the number of years that a student was eligible for this, isn't that? Can you clarify that?
Mr. Nolan. Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, you're right. I didn't make that update on this chart. It's been 4 years since we looked at some of these, and we didn't get everything. In the 2003 legislature, as part of the budget savings, a limitation of years was created in the LEP counts. In other words, for the purposes of generating revenue, LEP students are only allowed to generate revenue for 7 years, after which they can still continue to receive LEP services, but they will no longer be generating revenue for the district.
But now it's five.
Yeah, it used to be seven, Mr. Chair. I think they cut it. They reduced it.
I think it was
five. I apologize. It's now five.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Senator Wergen.
Well, Mr. Chair, the second piece of that, though, Mr. Nauman, was that the amount went down to 5 years, but the dollar increase, I believe, was from like 580 to 700. So there was a
yes.
dollar increase, however, the a dollar, year decrease.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Worgan, you're correct. And then that's why we see 700 and 250 on this slide. So I guess we updated part of it, but not all of it.
One of the things that I think one of the pieces of that legislation when it was passed, when we reduced it from 7 to 5, it wouldn't have been quite as bad, but I think it was retroactive. So what happened is it wasn't 5 years from the time the legislation was passed. If that student had been in there for 3 years, then you subtracted 3 from 5, and so you only had 2 years working forward. But there's we'll spend some time on this because I think this is an important issue for a lot of districts. I know Rochester has a tremendous increase in minority and LEP students. Is what triggers them? Where is that point where they should move on? And I think there's something to do with the testing of how proficient they are that we should be looking at. And then also, I believe Senator Scheid and Senator Olson had some proposals, which we spent some time on. Is there better ways of teaching English so that I think your proposal was an immersion kind of approach versus some other approaches. And so we may have some discussions on how we might maximize our dollars as well as where we should be putting them in.
And Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
I appreciate your comments. I just want to ask one clarifying question. The increased dollars that Senator Worgan mentioned, was that based on more kids or on a higher factor per child?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, what we did at the time was increase the allowances, the 700 and the 250, to normalize on for the reduced number of pupil counts. So at the time that the changes occurred,
right.
it was a zero cost item. Of course, as we move forward, it tended to save money over time as students were no longer counted for the purposes of generating revenue.
Mr. Allman.
There's $38.6 million in 07 for this line. Sparsity revenue. This is an important revenue item for some of the smaller, sparser school districts in the state. Districts with one or more sparsely populated school attendance areas receive additional funds to meet the higher costs of operating schools.
Mm-hmm.
It's comprised of two pieces, an elementary sparsity formula and a secondary sparsity formula. To be eligible for secondary sparsity, high schools within a district must have 400 ADMs or less and what we call an isolation index at a certain level. That's a very complicated formula on how we do that. At some point, this committee may want to get into that, but for now, we'll just refer to it. For elementary, schools within a district must be located 19 more miles from the next nearest elementary school and have 20 or fewer pupils per grade. And like the compensatory formula, elementary and secondary sparsity are keyed to the formula allowance. So when we increase the formula, unless that linkage is changed, additional dollars flow into this formula. There's about $20 million in there right now for 07.
I think the same thing for
transportation sparsity. This formula recognizes the additional costs of transporting students in districts with fewer students per square mile. This is also one of our more complicated formulas. In 1996, in fiscal year 97, $170, we used to have an old transportation formula, and $170 was rolled on to the formula allowance at that time. And this formula is a holdover from that old transportation formula, because at that point, 4.85% of that $170 represented 4.85% of the basic formula allowance. And so we created this formula to help deal with some of the overburdens of transportation costs. Transportation sparsity revenue is determined by the level of sparseness per square mile in the district, and it's the one formula we have a logarithm in, which is kind of interesting, used for calculating sparsity index and the density index. Sparsity index looks like this. The greater of two are the number of square miles in the district divided by the number of wadhams. Not AMCPUs. We still use wadhams in this. I think it's one of the only places. The density index is the square miles divided by the number of wadhams, and the density index cannot exceed 0.2 or less than 0.005. The formula is increased by the growth in the basic formula allowance, reduced by 4.85% of the formula. There's that 4.85% again. The logic is that this formula represents the overburdens of transportation costs. But when we rolled the old transportation formula on, it represented on the average $170 or 4.85% of the formula at the time. So we make a reduction for that 4.85% for that purpose. How confusing did I make that?
Very confusing.
It's one of our more complicated formulas, Senator.
Just a curious question. This one might be for our council. But is the school district required to spend? Well, since we rolled the transportation formula the transportation formula into the general formula, there's it's just all one pot of money, but. Is a district required to spend transportation money in their district? Or sparsity transportation in their district?
Mr. Chairman, no. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding. You mean if a district chooses to spend money transporting students from other school districts into their district? Is that where you're headed?
Right.
No, they're not required. A school district can elect to. They're not required to transport students from outside their district, but I know that in some parts of the state there are school districts that elect to do that as a way of encouraging open enrollment into their district. Okay. Does that answer?
It does, and I had a conversation with someone a couple days ago about, and this did happen in a couple different places where there were several buses. Two, three buses from different districts going down the same road.
Yes.
And the question to me was, you know, how efficient is our transportation system when you have all these buses going down the same road? And I'm not sure there's an answer, because I'm sure there's probably a logical reason, but it would be interesting to find out.
Mr. Chairman, I'll say this. Although we have that 4.85% as represented in the formula calculations, there is no requirement that a school district spend that amount or any amount. There's no transportation reserve, for example. And many districts are, in fact, spending higher amounts on transportation than this number represents. $59.7 million in 2007. Operating capital formula is used for repair and maintenance facilities, acquisition of land, purchase or lease equipment, purchase of books. Revenues must be placed in the this formula is somewhat unique in that the revenues must be placed in the district's operating capital account in the general fund. So this one is more restrictive. To calculate it, we create a maintenance cost index, which is 1 plus the average age of the school buildings in the district divided by 100.
Yeah.
And then that maintenance cost index gets added to a few allowances. And try to make this a little simple, but here's how it works. We take 100 times the MCI plus 68 plus 5. Districts with learning year programs receive an additional $30 per pupil at the learning year site. These are often summer programs. And what we do is we take the operating capital allowance, which we just created up above, and multiply it times the AMCPUs of the district, and that generates the operating capital revenue. The idea here is to scale this based on maintenance needs. So older school buildings would generate somewhat higher revenues off of this formula than the newer school buildings. And the theory being that there would be more operating capital needs in a school district with older buildings. There's $193.9 million in 07, and during the 03 session as well as the 05 session, this used to be an all-aid program, but it was converted to an aid levy split. So what we did was take some aid, what the legislature did, was take some of the aid and convert it into property taxes. There's now $102 million in levy estimated in 07, and the aid is $91.8 million. Okay. Hold on. This is the most complicated one we have. But we go through it on a number of charts in an attempt to hopefully demystify it. The equity revenue. equity revenue is calculated based on revenue that districts receive for other revenue programs. I want to say that again. Your revenue on this program is determined based on how much revenue you receive in other areas of the general education program. If you get a dollar here, it will help dictate what you get under this line. It was first created in 1999 to provide low property tax base districts who were unable to pass referenda with additional revenue. This has been frequently amended and adjusted to accomplish legislative goals. It now contains four separate formulas. So the original purpose has been somewhat diverted from. And in 2005, we equalized this formula. It used to be, it was originally all aid, and we also created property tax in this by converting some of that aid into property tax. So there's now $94.5 million in revenue. Of that, $64.5 million is levy, and $29.6 million of it is aid. Equity number one, I mentioned there's four. The first two are probably the most complicated. This piece is aimed at reducing the disparity between the highest and the lowest revenue district on a regional basis. Districts within the seven-county metro area comprise one region, and all the other districts comprise a second region. Districts are ranked top to bottom based on their combined basic and referendum revenue per pupil unit. Per AMCPU. Districts below the 95th percentile, so visualize ranking them top to bottom and establishing a percentage for each district. The district at the 95th percentile is eligible to receive equity revenue, equity one, and everyone below it is also eligible. But above that 95th percentile, you don't receive equity one. And statutorily, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are ineligible for this piece of the equity revenue. All eligible districts receive $13, and districts with operating referenda are eligible to receive additional equity revenue based on the district's percentile ranking. So the further below the 95th percentile you are, the more revenue you're going to get on that second piece. We create two calculations. One is a regional equity gap, and that's calculated as the 95th percentile minus the district at the 5th percentile. So you've got those two districts, one minus the other, and it creates a regional gap within. Remember, the districts are in two pots, the metro area and everyone else. So we do that calculation twice. Then we calculate the district at the 95th percentile minus the district for which we're trying to actually determine the revenue. And that gives us an equity index. and then we can do a formula from that. Formula is pretty simple once you have the index. It's $13 plus 75 times the equity index multiplied times the formula allowance.
Very simple.
Jesus.
Yeah. I can see the CA smiling, so it must not be that simple. And this one, I recognize that it's not, so we've taken a hypothetical situation, and we're going to try to walk you through this one. So first we'll do the equity gap, our 95th percent district minus our 5th percent district, and we've just got hypothetical numbers here. So the 5857 minus the 4601 gives us a difference between those two districts at 1256. Now what we're going to do is try to figure out the equity revenue for a district at the 25th percentile. So we'll calculate the district equity gap. So again, we take the 95th minus our district in question. We have 1077 for that district. So then we divide those two numbers, one over the other, and creates a ratio of about almost 86%. So what we're doing is weighting that $75 at 86% plus the $13 that everybody gets, and we generate a new allowance of 77.3. The idea is the further away from that 95th percentile you are, the more weight that 75 will have in the formula. If you're really close to it, you might only have a 2% weight on that $75. You multiply that times the number of pupils, and in this case, we've just hypothetically picked 2,000 pupils, and you get $154, right? $154,000. Did that help?
Yes.
Yeah, good. Now we have equity two. I warned you there's four pieces. We start with the total referendum value in the state, and I think this is a year old. We were at $586 million, and we had total RMCPUs at 931,000. We divide one over the other to get a statewide average of 629, and we take 10% of that, so 62.9. We do the same thing for our hypothetical district, total referendum revenue in the district divided by the number of pupils, and then we get 10. We subtract one from the other, 52.9. The math is pretty simple there. And then we drop it into a formula. So now we've created a new allowance for that district at 52.99 times the 2,000. We get $105,000 for this district. However, and this formula, I should quickly add, is for the small districts. So if we generate more than $100,000, we apply a test and we throw it out. If it is, and we just make it $100,000. So we go through all those calculations, and if you're over the test, it's gone, and we just give you $100,000. So that's the final equity two revenue.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's four different formulas. Do they apply to all districts, or does one only apply to a certain district? How do you decide that if that's the case?
Mr. Nolan.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, as I mentioned at the beginning, for equity one, we have a test. If you're above the 95th percentile or you're if Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Duluth, you're ineligible for revenue on the equity one. Here this is designed to provide revenue for the smaller school districts. The formula is drafted in such a way that only those that are close to being small are actually going to generate revenue. And if you're small but you generate more than $100,000, we apply that test and you only get $100,000. It was a way of limiting how much money was spent on this line item. I believe we did this in 2005, this second piece. Does that answer your question, Senator?
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator
Roland? could they be eligible for one and two?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Many are. Here's three, and this applies only to the metro area only. So we've got our equity one and equity two as the first part. And what we do is we take equity one and two and multiply it times 25%, and we give them an extra bump. $63,600 in this particular case. And again, this is all hypothetical. So in many cases, it would be very unlikely that you would have a metro school district there's probably a few examples that would qualify for the Equity 2 revenue and get the Equity 3 bump, but I'm just trying to combine them all together here for illustrative purposes.
Well, Senator Baugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelman, if a metro area school also fell within the 95 percentile, then they wouldn't be eligible for Equity number 3 revenue at all, correct?
Mr. Nelman.
Fell underneath the 95th percentile?
Above it, if they were...
If they were above it, they would not receive equity revenue number one, and
right.
In all likelihood would probably not receive equity number two,
right.
Because they don't meet the smallness criteria. And because equity three is calculated based on the sum of one and two, the answer would be no. And once we move into equity four, all districts receive some revenue off of equity four. And equity four is the pupil units calculate multiplied times $46, so in this example $92,000, and then we add them together, which generates $410,277. With one caveat: if you are above the 95th percentile and you don't get $46 multiplied times your formula, instead you get $23. This is a legislative compromise, so that those above the 95th percentile did get some revenue off of this. But in your example, Senator, they would only get the 23.
Thank you.
So now you have the revenue, and we also have to equalize it. I didn't do charts on that, but that's an aid and levy split as well. So some of that revenue would be raised by levy, and some of it would be raised by aid. Training and experience I'm going to go through fairly quickly because it's an old program that's phasing out. It partially compensated school districts for their salary differences that existed during the 96-97 school year. And the legislature decided to phase this out at that time period. So if you still have teachers on your payroll that were there in the 96-97 school year, they continue to calculate generate revenue for your school district. But we'll see as we move forward that I think by the end of the projection period, this is only generating about $1 million statewide, so it's getting smaller and smaller. We create an index times a number times a formula allowance times an allowance times your pupil counts. But as I mentioned, it's phasing out. And when they no longer have faculty from that time period, the revenue ceases to exist. As you see, there's only about 4.9 currently. It drops pretty precipitously after that. Gifted and Talented is a new program that was created in 2005. This allows school districts to provide staff development and local programs to teach gifted and talented students. It, too, is not a really big program. It began in fiscal 06, and it's simple. It's $9 times your pupil units. It's much like the formula allowance, except it's a much smaller number. $8.6 million in 07. Transition revenue was a new program in 04, and it helped create budget savings in the 03 session. It was calculated as a hold harmless provision for school districts while we were making other changes in the general formula. The revenue is calculated as the difference between a district's 03-04 general education revenue per pupil and the lesser of the following: either the district's 03-04 revenue had no law changes in the 03 session occurred, or the district's 02-03 revenue. So think about it this way. We had a February forecast in 03 that projected spending for school districts. They either got that number or the number that they had in the previous year, had there been no changes. And it created an allowance, and that allowance was locked in and would carry it forward every year. In 05, this became a mix of aid and levy. And it's $30.6 million Revenue in 07, $8.9 million in aid, and the levy is 21.6. And this may be our last slide and maybe a good break point after that. I wanted to make sure we get through the general education program, and maybe we'll hold the referendum for next week or for tomorrow. This was a new program beginning in 06. Governor Pawlenty pushed this program very, very strongly. Some call it Q-Comp, and the statutes it's referred to as alternative teacher compensation. It's designed to create incentives for districts to pay teachers based on merit rather than seniority. Districts are required to commit to paying teachers on that basis, in addition to the normal steps and lanes seniority process. Qualifying districts receive up to $260 per pupil in revenue, and there is an aid levy mix on this. Not all districts are eligible to qualify. This is fairly unique in general education, because normally in the general education program, if a district fits the criteria, if you've got poor students or LEP students or you're a sparse district, you generate the revenue. In this case, there is an administrative decision that involves in a sense, the blessing of a school district's plan, and we have a financial cap. So it can't exceed $100 million in total revenue, $75 million in aid and $24 million in levy. So there is a limit on the financial resources that the state has committed to this program, and that dictates a pecking order in the number of school districts that are eligible to receive the money. As I say, there was a financial cap originally envisioned of about $100 million in revenue. Right now, the revenue is about 30.6. The aid is about 8.9. There's 21.7 million. Not all the money is being spent right now. This would be the point where we'd move on to the operating referendum. But I think it's probably a good point to break.
I think, Mr. Norman, that's correct. I think this would be a good stopping point. And give us a little chance to absorb some of that knowledge and look over those sheets that you handed out. And we'll take off from where we left off. Take off tomorrow where we left off today. And I just want to thank you. The presentation is always excellent. I continue to learn, and it's always stimulating. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'll just, if it's okay, I will offer that I know there's a lot here, and we are perfectly happy to go through this a second time individually with members. We will also make that offer at the fiscal briefing this afternoon, where we're going to just talk about education more generally. If members want to go through this in greater detail, we'd be pleased to set up either individual sessions or a group of members to do that.
Well, thank you very much. And members, we'll see you tomorrow at 8:30. 8:30. Committee is adjourned.
Thank you.